Baltimore has plenty of blocks like this one. Boarded up row houses, broken windows, bulletproof glass at the corner market. Across the street, there's an unremarkable-looking elementary school, Harriet Tubman. Practically all the students here get free or reduced lunches. Some of the kids live in homeless shelters. But here's the thing. Harriet Tubman seems to have an invisible force field around it that makes the school somehow different from the rest of the neighborhood. Dan Trahey struggles every day to keep that force field intact. And he doesn't even work for the school. He works for the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. He's standing next to the jungle gym that the BSO helped install a few months ago.
Imagine, we're looking at the ground right now, and imagine this is the playground, and this was like a crystal field of full of broken bottles, glass. It was awful. We would be crunching under our shoes right now. And actually, our director of finance, you know, being very good with numbers and very meticulous, she sat out here for like 5 hours on her hands and knees picking up all these little pieces of glass and using a sieve and getting the good dirt out. So
it's not an environment where you would imagine a lot of Mozart.
No, not at all. But hopefully it'll ring through these streets very soon.
Dan Trahey runs a program called ORCHIDS. It's spelled O-R-C-H, kids, like orchestra kids. It's a collaboration between the BSO and Harriet Tubman School. The idea is to introduce disadvantaged students to classical music and maybe change their lives in the process. As we walk through the shiny red school doors, the neighborhood blight disappears.
You see, we painted the brick in here. Actually, Marin did this.
Marin Alsop, the maestra of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, painted the brick walls in this elementary school.
Let me show you some pictures. It's pretty amazing. She's a better conductor than she is painter, but she,
I won't tell you said
great.
That. Walking through the halls, older students ask Dan Trahey if they can help with ORCHIDS. This is the first year of the project, and it's starting with the younger students. Each year, it'll grow to eventually encompass the whole school. Every kid here seems to want to be involved in the program. In truth, it's basically the only thing there is to do after school.
Everyone, ORCHIDS, you need to be lined up over here.
Upstairs, the ORCHIDS practice room is a warm, bright space. IKEA cabinets for walls, potted plants on top. Kids often drag their parents upstairs to show them there are actually live plants growing indoors.
The kids need to be in the most positive environment they can be, and probably a lot of the other spaces they're in, none of these things have been thought about. I mean, the colors on the walls, what's on their walls, what they're seeing, all that. So we wanted to make it the best we could for them.
Yeah. You're a trained musician. You have an MFA. You've played in orchestras. Mm-hmm. So did you always know that you wanted to bring music to places where they might not have a lot of classical music exposure in their lives?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I mean, I felt like I was performing for the wrong audience. I mean, I felt like the people that I was performing for, they didn't really need it. And I wanted to perform for people that I felt needed it.
Explain to me what you mean by that, because I think people understand the need for food and the need for clothing. You say people need this music. What do you mean?
Well, I think there's something that we feel inside of us that brings out emotions that we can't bring out through talking or through reading that music brings out. There's something that triggers in the brain that helps us get to deeper rooted emotions, and I think it's something that these kids really need.
ORCHIDS is based on Venezuela's program El Sistema. That program's been going for more than 30 years, and it's all over the country. El Sistema's graduates include Gustavo Dudamel. He's about to become musical director of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Venezuela's government pays for El Sistema. ORCHIDS is not government-funded. So far, Harriet Tubman is the only place it exists, and it fits right in with the school principal's plan for her students. Kimberly Sollers is fiery, proud, and practical. We met her in the principal's office, but she's almost never there. She spends all day in classes with her kids. She's been at the school less than a year. The last principal was forced out when the school failed No Child Left Behind standards. I asked Ms. Sollers, how will a new paint job help kids who don't have food and clothes?
But our school has more than just a new paint job. I'm a believer that when they cross that threshold, they've come into a place that's all about them. And that paint job wasn't done by a bunch of strangers. It was done by the kids. It was done by the community. It was done by Baltimore Symphony Orchestra members. So it's more than a paint job. It's a paint job to an outsider, but it's love to us, and our kids know that.
Down the hall, Dan Trahey has gathered some of his first grade ORCHIDS in the cafeteria to show us what they've been learning.
I want to start with our mouths. We're going to do some rhythms with our mouths, and then I'm going to actually have you do something on the table. But I want you to have your hands in rest position.
okay? I want your bottoms and your feet to be pianissimo, right? As soft as possible, okay? Eyes on me, please. Ariance, eyes on me. You ready? Start with this one. Ba, 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 da, ba.
Ba, 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 ba.
Ba, 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 da, ba.
Ba, 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 ba.
Boo, ba, ba, da, ba.
Boo, ba, ba, ba.
Ba, ba, da, ba, da, ba, ba.
Ba, 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 ba.
Let's use some of our hands. Let's start very simply with them, okay? Can you repeat after me? Mississippi hot dog. I like peas. I like peas. Do it. Was that Mississippi hot dog, I like peas, I like peas?
No, yeah, I like cheese.
I like cheese. Oh, yeah. I misremembered the title of the song. So who can tell? You guys looked so focused when you guys were doing those rhythms. Who can tell me what's going through your head while you're doing that? Asia, right?
I was concentrating and I was listening.
Do you, when you're in class during the day, do you think about that concentrating and that listening?
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me more about that.
I know 100 plus 4.
Asia starts showing me her math skills. Another girl named Ariance says doing this music makes her feel sad.
Sometimes I feel sad deep in my heart.
Why?
Because a lot of people will look at you playing an instrument.
So when you're up there playing an instrument, you imagine people watching you?
Yeah.
And being proud of you?
And then they clap for you, and they settle down for you, and they will not talk for you.
The idea of adults settling down, not talking, listening to these kids, is a big deal.
That made you move.
Oh, look at this. Look at all the boxes.
The day we visited was a major event. The students were about to see their instruments for the first time. BSO Maestro Marin Alsup has arrived. So has the truck.
So grab one instrument, and then we'll head upstairs. Do you want to actually give them one of the instruments to carry up?
Sure. Come on. Yeah, grab that. Okay. What do you want? You want that one?
No, I want that one right there.
Okay, that one. You go.
Kids are carrying boxes bigger than they are, literally an orchestra's worth of instruments. They haul their stash upstairs to the orchids room, where they sit and listen to the woman they call Miss Mary.
Yes, instruments. Yeah. So you know what I brought? I wanted to show you my violin, because this is a violin that I've had, since I was just a little bit taller than you are. And so, isn't it beautiful?
Yeah.
Isn't that pretty?
Woo!
But you know what? Having an instrument is like having a pet. You have to take good care of it. Not that I'm advocating that you all play the violin, but you really should.
Each kid gets to try an instrument. It's like opening Christmas gifts.
Is that what you want to play?
No. Let's check it out. Look at this. It's brand new, too. So let's pull it out of its cage. Now, I need you to see that you go like this with your lips if you want to play this. Everybody, watch. Watch my lips. I want to see this. It's actually more like a bee than a horse. It's like this. Can anyone do that?
Yes.
Let me see it. So put your lips really tight together and go.
Lips closed. Yeah.
First sound, lovely.
First sound.
Your parents are going to be thrilled.
After each kid plays a few notes, they trickle out of the building, and Marin Alsup sits down, looking happy.
In these last couple of hours, as the kids were getting their musical instruments, what was your internal monologue?
I was kind of jealous. Isn't that terrible? Because, and I'm from a family of professional musicians.
Yeah.
But, you know, my parents were always, okay, here's the piano, play it. You're going to be a concert pianist. You know, okay, that didn't work. Let's get to the violin. You know, I didn't have the opportunity to try a trumpet. I mean, can you imagine being able to try instruments until you feel that this is the one for you?
She has a lot riding on this program, and not only personally. Alsup contributed $100,000 from her MacArthur Genius Grant to help fund this project. And she's starting it when many other arts organizations are laying people off, or worse.
Economic hard times are going to come and go, but our responsibility doesn't come and go. I mean, just because we hit a major speed bump, I think that's the moment to step up even further and to be bold and to do something important. And maybe in some ways it enables us to remember that, you know, life is not about money.
Well, $100,000 is much better spent on this than in the stock market.
Well, clearly this was the best $100,000 I've ever spent because the rest is only worth $50,000.
Alsop says she can't wait to see her orchestra of 90 kids from this neighborhood playing side by side with her musicians from the Baltimore Symphony. Maybe not next year, but in a decade, she says, definitely. You can see a video blog of the Harriet Tubman students at our blog, npr.org/soapbox. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro. Scott Simon's back next week. Rolling Stone magazine has called the band Blitzentrapper the best Grateful Dead knockoff in forever. True enough, but frankly, that shortchanges what this band is doing. Drifting down the sleepy river, waking like a child. You never gonna know what the spirit's saying. Blitzentrapper's new album is called Fur. The record made Rolling Stone's list of the best albums of 2008, and it also made the list of best CDs of the year in the NPR All Songs Considered listeners poll. Blitzentrapper's songwriter and lead singer is Eric Early, and he came to the studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland to talk with us. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. I understand your dad was a bluegrass musician?
That's right.
And he taught you to play your first instrument?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I still got a banjo that he gave me.
Is there a track on this album that features you playing the banjo that we might take a listen to?
Oh, you could play the banjo so off of Saturday Night, it's kind of funny. That kind of organy sounding thing, accordion sounding thing is the melodica.
The melodica? What's the melodica? Yeah.
It's a sort of weird German instrument that you blow into. It was used by the Dub Kings, you know, by all the dub guys from Jamaica back in the 70s.
So that, were you playing your dad's banjo there, the one that your dad gave
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah, that's a Kentucky made.
Tell me about the piano that you wrote most of this stuff on.
I don't even know whose it is. It got left out in the hallway of our studio space, and so me and Brian one day just pulled it into our studio.
Brian's your bandmate?
He's a drummer, yeah. Just kind of had it in there, and I started writing songs on it at night and recording with it. It was a beat-up old thing. We don't have it anymore. We just sort of left it in the hallway when we moved out.
Was there something about composing a song on a piano that sounded terrible that made the songs develop differently?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it sounds terrible. I mean, it definitely is slightly out of tune, and I mean, I don't know. I think that it sounds unique, and also it was all I had at the studio anyway, so. In my sleep, I'm not your lover. All I know is in my sleep I'm not your lover anymore.
There's kind of a clicking sound in the background. Is that that piano?
Yeah, you can hear the hammers smacking. The thing with that piano is that the front of it had broken off. So you could see the interior of it, the guts of it. And you could also hear it.
When you're on tour and you have a beautifully tuned grand, do you feel a little nostalgic for this old clacker?
Like sometimes, yeah. Although not that much.
I want to ask about your Portland influences. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I was reading an old interview that one of your bandmates did, and I kind of found the question perfectly phrased, so I'm going to quote directly from this interview that was on brightestyoungthings.com, a blog. And the interviewer said, "This is sort of a backwards way of getting you to say that it's the best state in the union, but how do you think Oregon has affected or influenced you?"
I mean, there's a certain darkness to Portland, the weather and the economy. But I think there's also a certain warmth and familiarity that goes along with it.
Where'd the story of the Black River Killer come from?
It was just a little while past the Sunset Strip. They found the girl's body in an open pit. Her mouth was sewn shut, but her eyes were still wide, gazing through the fog to the other side.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of like a conglomeration of different ideas. I mean, I was drawing heavily off of, you know, like Cormac McCarthy's style narrative.
The novelist.
But it's also based sort of on my Uncle Tommy, my father's lost brother, who was a criminal, a junkie, and a really sweet guy.
What was his story?
You know, he, as a kid, he was around a little bit. And when we'd visit L.A., you know, he was the guy with the big beard, with the stained T-shirt that was, you know, always like playing Rolling Stones songs in my grandfather's back shed, you know.
It was dark as the grave, it was just about three, when the warden with his key came to set me free. They gave me $5 and a second-hand suit, a pistol and a hat and a worn-out blue. So I took the bus down to the Rio Grande, and I shot a man down on the edge of town. Then I stole me a horse and I rode it around, till the sheriff pulled me in and he set me.
And then as I got older, he disappeared. After my grandfather died, he disappeared. And the cops would come to our house in Oregon once a year looking for him. Have you heard from Tommy? We're looking for him. He's pulled a heist in such and such city, you know, that kind of thing. And so I kind of always had this, like, a mythical view of Tom, you know, and, like, you know, he's down on the border, like, running guns, or I don't even know. We haven't heard from him for 10 years, maybe? Not more than that.
Huh.
Probably 15 years.
Did he ever do anything like the Black River Killer in the song?
I don't know. I mean, he didn't kill anybody that I know of. He might have. I have no idea. I think the best story about him that my father used to tell me was in the late 60s, Tommy got on a chain gang for possession. And back then, you know, they would chain him up and they would work, usually digging ditches. And he escaped from the chain gang one afternoon. And he was wearing, you know, his prison garb. And he stole a car and headed back towards my dad's house in East L.A., and he got pulled over. So he's just escaped from a chain gang, stolen a car, and he gets pulled over. And my Uncle Tommy was such a sweet talker that he talked the cop out of the ticket and rolled up into my dad's driveway in a stolen car. And my dad's like, "What are you doing here?" Yeah.
And did your dad turn him in?
No.
Wow.
Well, the sheriff let me go with a knife and a song. So I took the first train up to Oregon, and I killed the first man that I came upon. Cause the devil works quick, you know, it don't take long.
I should say we have not played the title track off your album, Fur. And that's because listeners heard it during All Things Considered segment on the best albums of 2008. But if you want to listen to it in full, it's on npr.org. Eric Early of Blitz and Trapper, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, same to you.
Sean Goldsmith isn't much of a hunter, but he is a Boy Scout, and he just managed to earn a merit badge for shotgun shooting.
First time I picked up a shotgun, and I'm about to shoot, and then I pull the trigger, and I almost fall backwards on my face.
A narrow escape, and part of an epic quest Sean just finished on Long Island. He earned 121 badges in all, every single one possible. You only need 21 to get the title Eagle Scout, so this is an eagle with a wide wingspan. And it took more than tying square knots and starting campfires.
I had to do sculpture. I had to do a surveying.
Now, these badges aren't exactly easy to get. If you look in the scouting manual, there are multiple requirements for each one. And we printed out the workbook for the journalism merit badge, and that's 5 pages long. There's even a badge in nuclear science. To earn that one, you could build your own electroscope and place a radiation source inside, or just take a field trip to your nearest particle accelerator. Some of the badges are even death-defying. Take the one for water skiing.
That was really difficult because when the boat's going 50 miles an hour and you hit a bad wave and you take it the wrong way, you can fall and go flying And when that happened to me, my life preserver, which was zipped in, it had all the buttons on it, they all popped off and everything fell off because I hit with such impact.
And there are badges for stamp collecting, dentistry, space exploration, even insect study.
So I'd go around with plastic Ziploc bags and have to try to, like, swipe the bugs in the bags. And at one point, I was carrying, like, 15 or 20 bags of bugs. And I would, like, look on the ground, like, I'd be, like, falling on my hands and knees. And people would, like, say, what is this kid doing?
And why do this? Why earn all 121 merit badges? Why collect the bugs and shoot the guns and learn about nuclear science?
Well, if I run into a stranger, there's definitely something I can talk about. I have 121 topics to talk about.
Sean Goldsmith, Eagle Scout extraordinaire. Our parting words today come from another overachiever, legendary conductor Leonard Bernstein. He said, to achieve great things, two things are needed, a plan and not quite enough time. That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Have a great night.
In these tough economic times, many Americans are struggling to pay for health care or health insurance. And hospitals in Mexico are expanding in hopes of attracting more patients from north of the border. A growing industry is now marketing medical tourism to Americans. Hospitals in Tijuana, just half an hour's drive from San Diego, can do many medical procedures for half or a third of the cost in the U.S. NPR's Jason Bobian reports.
Grupo Angeles is the largest private hospital network in Latin America. Their hospital in Tijuana is a modern six-story building. Its glass lobby, accented with orange, looks like it could be the set for a soap opera.
This is our emergency room. We have four observation cubicles.
Carlos Zavala Ruiz, the business director for Hospital Angeles Tijuana, says this facility opened 3 years ago.
All the equipment and everything is just basically brand new.
Right now, about 50% of this hospital's business comes from north of the border. Americans mainly come for elective surgeries, hip and knee replacements, laser eye surgery, plastic surgery. The greatest number come for treatments of extreme obesity. Hospital Angeles does gastric bypass surgeries. They insert gastric sleeves and install lap bands. Zavala says the cost of these procedures in Tijuana is just a fraction of what they'd cost in the States. Take, for example, a lap band surgery.
I think you will find that a lap band in the United States, it's about $18,000 right now, $16,000.
Compared to here, what is it going to cost?
$7,000.
He says their overhead is far less than in a U.S. hospital. Wages are also far cheaper. A nurse just a few miles north in California might earn $70,000 a year. A starting nurse here earns $500 a month. Zavala says the potential for growth in treating Americans is huge. Grupo Angeles plans to open 12 more hospitals in Mexico over the next 5 years, much of this to cater to international clients. Miriam Gray is a nurse from Wisconsin. She's recovering in a private room at Hospital Angeles after gastric bypass surgery.
I'd probably like to lose at least 125 pounds, which is a lot, but I'd like to.
Gray has a body mass index of 42, which is categorized as extremely obese. After years of failed diets, she hopes gastric bypass surgery will finally help her lose weight. She flew from Wisconsin into San Diego, where a driver from the hospital met her and brought her here. Gray, who doesn't speak Spanish, says the entire procedure has gone even smoother than she'd expected.
I was checked in, had my blood work drawn and an x-ray all within about an hour. I know that that is possible in the United States. I mean, I work in hospitals. It just doesn't happen that fast.
Gray paid $12,000 for this operation, about a third of what she says it would have cost her back home in Wisconsin. The medical tourism industry has been around for a while. Costa Rica has marketed its hospitals to foreigners for years. Even Cuba has a bustling business selling healthcare procedures to Canadians and Europeans. But these arrangements have generally been a single person paying for a single procedure abroad. Now there's a movement to offer cut-rate health plans that provide traditional health care, but some big-ticket benefits may only be offered outside the country. Blue Cross Blue Shield of South Carolina last year set up an affiliate to offer benefits abroad. In June of this year, the American Medical Association, for the first time, issued medical tourism guidelines. Terry White with Bridge Health International is marketing health plans to businesses in which some of the procedures are only available in, say, Thailand, Costa Rica, or Mexico. White says participation in these plans should be voluntary.
The patient should not be forced to go to an international destination because, you know, their plan only offers surgery in Mexico or something like that.
What he's offering, he says, is healthcare coverage that can save both consumers and employers significant amounts of money.
This needs to be about the empowered healthcare consumer who's able to make choices that have an economic impact with the assurance that they're getting good quality when they go someplace.
And like Carlos Zavala at Hospital Angeles in Tijuana, White sees the potential market for international healthcare, particularly in an economic downturn, to be huge. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
A few little earthquakes here or there, that's just a part of everyday life when you live on top of the largest supervolcano in North America. That volcanic system is what powers Yellowstone National Park. But in the last 8 days, there have been more than 400 earthquakes at Yellowstone. So should we be worried? It's this week's Science Out of the Box. Hank Hessler is a Park Service geologist, and he's on the line with us from his office at Yellowstone. Mr. Hessler, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
At least 400 earthquakes in a little more than a week. Is the ground still shaking there?
It definitely is. The earthquake swarm is continuing.
And is it a little odd? Is it a little creepy?
Well, for the individuals who are within a few miles of the earthquakes, and that includes a Park Service settlement we have there called Lake, they have commented to me that they would appreciate it if the earthquakes would stop so they could get a good night's sleep.
Hey, I mean, is this normal? I mean, how common is it to have so many earthquakes at Yellowstone?
It's not normal. This is an unusual sequence of having this many earthquakes in this short of time period. But having a lot of earthquakes over a short time period in the same area is the definition of an earthquake swarm. And we've had much larger earthquake swarms in Yellowstone in the past. Back in 1985, there was an earthquake swarm that lasted for 3 months and had a magnitude 4.7 earthquake associated with it. The current swarm has had a maximum earthquake of only 3.9, and that did not cause any structural damage. However, it was felt as far away as Old Faithful, which is about 30 miles away. Most of the earthquakes have only been felt quite locally within a few miles of the earthquakes.
Now, Yellowstone actually sits on top of a supervolcano. What is a supervolcano, and how is it different from a normal volcano?
The difference between a supervolcano and a regular volcano is simply the difference between a supersized drink and a regular drink. A supervolcano just means it has the potential for a very large catastrophic eruption.
And is that why there are so many geysers at Yellowstone?
Correct. The reason Yellowstone was created as the world's first national park is because of all the hot water features, the geysers, the mud pots, the steam vents, the hot springs, and all those thermal features are fueled by the molten rock that's just a few miles below the surface at Yellowstone.
With all of these earthquakes happening, the swarm, should we start panicking? I mean, does it mean that there could be a volcanic eruption under Yellowstone National Park?
This particular earthquake swarm is not indicating an imminent volcanic eruption at this time. The earthquake energy associated with this swarm and the number of quakes and magnitude is well within the historic earthquake activity for Yellowstone. So right now, we are not concerned about this indicating any sort of volcanic activity. However, we are very closely monitoring this earthquake swarm with all the new tools at hand that seismologists and scientists have. And there will be many months of work after the swarm stops in order to try to figure out the precise cause of these earthquakes.
Hank Hessler is a geologist who works at Yellowstone National Park. We spoke with him by phone from his office. Mr. Hessler, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Next week, Apple fans will once again gather in San Francisco for Mac World Expo. Unlike previous years, the keynote speech this time will not be delivered by Apple founder Steve Jobs. Since Jobs and Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak have always been entertaining speakers, our science correspondent Robert Krulwich has a gift to take the place of the keynote address. A couple of naughty tales from the two Steves. The first one from Mr. Wozniak, the second from Mr. Jobs.
It was 1970-something, the early 1970s, and Steve Wozniak, future inventor of the Apple I computer, was then at Berkeley, and he was how old?
I think about this. I'd say I was 20.
And one day, he told me at the 92nd Street Y in New York City, he picked up an Esquire magazine, and he read about a guy named Captain Crunch, not his real name, who had figured out how to make international phone calls for free by whistling a certain tone into the phone. It was a high E.
Yes. You could dial any call anywhere in the world just by that method. Now, this guy, Joe Andresi,
Jr. You'd whistle this high E into the phone, and then you'd get a free line?
Well, if you whistle, that's a one. If you whistle, that's a two. Three of them is a three.
He makes free long-distance calls by mouth, in effect.
That's correct.
Well, Steve decided he had to meet this guy, the whistling guy. So he called one of his best friends and future Apple partner, Steve Jobs. At this point, Jobs was still in high school. And together, they figured out that Captain Crunch actually lived pretty close by.
We found the main phone freak, Captain Crunch, who discovered that the little whistle given away in Captain Crunch cereal, if you blew it, you got that high note that seized the phone line at your command. And he was not caught yet by the FBI. They didn't know who he was, and we stumbled onto him. Yeah, Steve and I did.
What's more, Wozniak asked the captain over to his college dorm room.
He actually came to the door at my dorm in Berkeley, and everyone wanted to see what this guy looks like, the suave engineer who's smarter than the phone company engineers. And I open it up, and here's this guy with his hair all strangly, and he's kind of smelling, he's missing a bunch of teeth. And I was a little shocked. I was expecting something different. And I said, "Are you?" And he says, "I am he, Captain Crunch."
So Captain Crunch taught the Steves how to do the whistles using a device called a blue box, which they built. And once they had their own blue box, they wondered,
"Should we try the technique that Crunch just taught us to make calls on a payphone?" Yeah, let's try it. We got to learn.
And learn they did. Soon they were making calls everywhere for free.
You dial calls through satellite to country, to another country, around the world, to the phone next to you. And it's just so amazing, intriguing. And you'd like to show it off to people that don't know it's possible.
So because they could, and because they were now very good at it.
We're in college and we're young, and this is not too far away from when we would do Apple Computer, yeah.
Steve Wozniak decided to go all the way.
One time I called the Pope. And I said, "This is Henry."
What time you called the Pope? Why did you think of the Pope? I mean, that's kind of a tough call.
I don't know how I thought of it. I just thought of I called Italy inward. I asked for Rome inward. I got to the Vatican. I asked for the Pope. I said, "This is Henry Kissinger calling on behalf with Richard Nixon at the summit meeting in Moscow." And I didn't even
Did you use an accent? Or
Not at first, but I was talking to an operator, and she said, "Well, until 5:30 here in the morning. Why don't you call back in an hour?" So I called back in an hour.
Oh, my God. What do you mean? Did you think that you were actually maybe going to be able to speak to the Pope?
Oh, absolutely. I thought I might get there. Yeah, sure. Huh. Amazing things happen, you know, when you're coming.
Had you planned what to tell him? Had he gotten online?
No. I don't know. I probably would have just said, "Oh, is this really the Pope?"
An hour later, Wozniak did call back to the Vatican.
And I got to the bishop who was going to be the translator. And this is like the top bishop. And I said, I used a Henry Kissinger accent by then. And I said, "Can I talk to the Pope?" And he says, "You're not Henry Kissinger. I just spoke to Henry Kissinger." I guess they had called to check up on my story.
So the Vatican very gently hung up on Steve Wozniak. That was about 37 years ago. But it's not like Wozniak or his old partner Steve Jobs have ever stopped their pranks. At a Macworld meeting a couple of years ago in 2007, Jobs was introducing his now famous iPhone.
"What I'm going to do is I'm going to go look for something. I'm going to certainly want a cup of coffee afterwards."
And to demonstrate how his phone worked right there, live, he picked up the iPhone, punched in some instructions to locate nearby coffee shops.
"So I'm just going to look for Starbucks, right?"
And he tapped the keys, and up came a map showing all the
sure
nearby
enough,
Starbucks.
There's all the Starbucks.
Then he chose the closest one.
And there it is, and let's give him a call.
"Good
morning, Starbucks, and how can I help you?
Yes, I'd like to order 4,000 lattes to go, please. No, just kidding. Wrong number. Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay.
The thing is, there is something about playing with telephones that for four decades now has made both Steve Wozniak and Steven Jobs just a little bit crazy. Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.